What is known as the Battered Women's Movement began with the opening of the first shelter in London, an effort by a woman named Erin Pizzey. The year was 1970. Pizzey's later book, published in 1974, was called Scream Quietly, or The Neighbors Will Hear. It was a path-breaking book. Its title, by itself, told the story of domestic violence in the 1970s. In some ways, in 1990, much is the same for women who are battered. And in some ways, much has changed. Battered women in this country still scream quietly for fear others will hear. But they can, throughout the United States, find refuge in over 1,200 shelters and crisis centers. Hello, I'm Susan McInnes, your host for Conversations for KUAC-FM Fairbanks. Today's guest is a woman who endured violence in her own home for years, and for the past 16 years, Tilly Blackbear has gained her own freedom from violence and worked to help others across the chasm. Ms. Blackbear is a founder and presently chairwoman for the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, based in Washington, D.C. She was, for 4 years, the director of the White Buffalo Calf Women's Society, based at the Rosebud Sioux Nation in South Dakota. It is the oldest known shelter on an American Indian reservation. Welcome, Tilly Blackbear. Thanks for joining us today. You are what is known as a foremother or a founding mother for the NCADV, the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. That organization was founded in 1978, is that right?
Yes.
Can you give us a picture of what that period of time was like in terms of domestic violence, what it might have been like for an individual woman and for the society as you saw it when you were helping to form NCADV?
Okay. Maybe I can just give you a little bit of a history how NCADV first got started. In January of 1978, the U.S. Civil Rights Commission was having two days hearings on wife beating, as they called it then. And they brought in women from throughout the nation that were invited to make presentation at the hearings. And I came in from the White Buffalo Calf Women's Society on the subject of short-term shelter needs. And there was two tracks, long-term needs and short-term needs. And many of the programs throughout the United States were just beginning to get started. And being women, you know, recognizing that there was 200 or 300 of us at this hearing, we decided that we would use as much of it, of the time that we were there together, to coalesce and to do start the networking. We all felt that there needed to be a national organization or a national network to voice our concerns. And so by the end of the first day, the women began to start talking in the bathroom and talking about what was needed. By the end of the second day, we had loosely formed a network of women. We decided, I think, on 20 women that would come together and try to meet that spring. It just so happened that also at the same time, there was some legislation that was introduced into Congress, and many of us were going to be at those hearings to make presentations. And so we all tried to get back together. We all came back to D.C. in February and March for those hearings, and we began to work really closely together on NCADV. And we incorporated in the state of Oregon because it was the state where we could incorporate real quickly. And then we started the whole of getting ourselves organized nationwide. And I was also probably the only Native American woman there at those hearings. And because I was from South Dakota, and being the only Indian woman there, you know, kind of helped me to get really involved from the very beginning. And one of the things that we decided that for all of us that were involved was that we would go back to our own states and organize them into coalitions or networks if they weren't organized as such. And so I was given the task of going back to South Dakota to organize my state. And my reaction at the time was like, me go back to South Dakota, do you know that I'm an Indian woman?
Mm-hmm.
You know, South Dakota's mostly, you know, it's predominantly redneck. And I said, me, you know? And it was like, well, you know, we all had to do this work. And so I went back to my state, and I was in graduate school at the time, and I did approach the South Dakota Commission on the Status of Women to see if they would help me, because they knew I needed to do this work. And they agreed to do the publicity and all the mailings for a meeting. And then I went back to the White Buffalo Calf Women's Society at Rosebud and asked them if they would host this meeting on the reservation. So we decided on a day in June. And when that came in June, we had 77 women from throughout the state of South Dakota come.
That's quite a number for that time, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. To that meeting. And then at the end of that day, we formed the South Dakota Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And so, but at the same time, I was also working on the national, on NCADV. And we started to meet throughout the country about every 3 months. And I was the first secretary to NCADV. And a lot of that was because I had, you know, secretarial skills. And we organized and began to have our meetings throughout the United States. And I was with in the initial, initial beginnings of NCADV. We were very, we didn't have a national office at the time. We didn't get a national office until, I believe it was 1980. We finally opened up an office in D.C., and the woman opened up an office in her home. We hired her. But up till then, we had all volunteered our time and our efforts. We would get other people to fund us to go to the meetings, or we would drive. Mm-hmm. You know, we met at YWCAs throughout the country. We met at shelters. We met at people's homes. In August of 1978, I brought the steering committee. And NCADV is built upon a philosophy of unity through diversity. And we respect and recognize each other's diversity and try to be inclusive rather than exclusive of our differences. Mm-hmm. And
those words mean racial differences, age differences,
right,
cultural differences, and the like.
In August of 78, no, August of 79, a year after we had formed, I invited the steering committee to Rosebud, where I'm from. And when they came, you know, they stayed in a big National Guard armory tent because we didn't have motel rooms to house them. And, you know, my mother had to cook for them. Many of them were vegetarians. And one of my brother's reactions to that was like, well, they're not going to know if you take the meat out before you serve them the soup. This is my brother's reaction. But one of the things that we've had 5 national conferences. We just finished our 5th one in Amherst 2 weeks ago. And the first national conference was held in Washington in 1980. And we expected maybe 300 or 400 women to come, and we ended up with 600 or 700 women at that first national conference. And then a couple years later, we had one at Marquette University in Milwaukee. And then in 1986, we had one at St. Louis at George Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. And then in 1988, we met in Seattle, Washington. And then 2 weeks ago, we had our 5th national conference in Amherst, Massachusetts. But NCADV is built upon, we don't call ourselves a board of directors. We have a steering committee. And we make all our decisions through the consensus. We utilize the consensus decision-making process through the way we handle the affairs. Each state that is a member of NCADV sends a representative to the steering committee, and we meet 3 times a year. We meet usually in January and May and September. In September, our September meeting is always held in Washington, D.C., because it's also time for us to do some lobbying in D.C. on women's issues. But the other 2 times, we move pretty much throughout the nation to have our steering committee meetings. And we have, within our structure, we have what we call task forces. The task forces were created at NCADV to support disenfranchised women within our movement. So within the NCADV, we have the Battered Women and Formerly Battered Women Task Force, and we have the Women of Color Task Force, the Lesbian Task Force, the Child Advocacy Task Force, the Rural Task Force, and the Jewish Women Task Force. And within the task forces, we also have caucuses. Like within the Lesbian Women Task Force, we have the Battered Lesbian Caucus. And within the Women of Color Task Force, we have the Latina Caucus. And I know that in Amherst, just recently, there was a lot of caucuses that were formed, such as the Women in Recovery, Survivals, Women of Sexual Survivals, Survival, I believe, Sexual Abuse, mm-hmm. Survivors of Sexual Abuse, and the American Indian Women, Asian Women Caucuses of all are things that were just newly formed a couple weeks ago. And so and along with that, with our task forces, they have a lot of power within the movement. As far as when we have our steering committee meetings, they can caucus at any time, stop the meeting, you know, to have a caucus too if they feel that something isn't going the way it should be going, respectfully. But another part of that too is that with the Women of Color Task Force, which is basically women that self-identify as women of color, belong to the task force. And along with that, our ally in that is the white women in our group. And they have what we call a working group. It does not have a task force status. And we have the white women working against racism working group. And they have only a working group status within a national organization because white women are part of the majority in our society. And they have privileged status. You know, they're not disenfranchised as the other task forces that we have. And so in order to equate that power within our movement, they have this working group status. And they work pretty closely with the Women of Color Task Force in supporting our issues. And they also work with each other within the group to hold each other accountable to their racism. And that really, you know, racism is an issue that we work with a lot within our battered women's movement, that racism is an issue of battering. And, you know, along with that, we also work on issues of sexism because the majority of women who get battered are women, and it becomes an issue of sexism within the movement. Oppression is also an issue that we deal with very strongly. Homophobia, you know, ageism, sexism, anti-Semitism, yeah. So these are all issues that we're very cognizant about
and so
in the movement.
In structuring the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, you have structured it in response to the work that you do to work against that which perpetuates such things as domestic violence or sexual assault. Is that accurate?
Yeah. We tied into those different issues because they're all part of that. But part of that, too, is the whole issue of power and control, which is at the core of battering. Who's really in control and who's, you know... violence is a learned behavior. And we look at the issues of sexism or the issues of oppression, and we look at the society that we exist in. And the society, who actually is in position of power and control within our society? It's men. Our society is patriarchal in nature. All the institutions that we relate to, the religious institutions, you know, are all patriarchal in system, the government is. And so we look at it as issues of power and control. And until in the society, until women can reach that status of equality, you know, battering is going to continue. Violence against women and children is going to be around for a long time.
You're listening to Conversations on KUAC-FM, and my guest today is Tilly Black Bear, Tilly Blackbear is, if you turned in late, is one of the founders of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, the organization which Ms. Blackbear has just been describing. She was, for 4 years, until February of 1990, the executive director of the White Buffalo Calf Women's Society. One of its duties is to act as a shelter for women who are battered. That society exists on the Rosebud Sioux Nation in South Dakota. Can you expand on that imbalance of power? I know there will be people listening today who are not accustomed to those terms, who see America as an egalitarian society with each person, regardless of gender or color or age, having equal opportunities or at least an open chance to get what he or she needs. This is not true in your thinking, clearly. Can you tell me how you view this nation, and especially as it relates to domestic violence, the thing with which you've been working for so many years?
Okay. I can relate this in a couple of ways. One, as an indigenous woman, as an Indian woman from South Dakota, and also, you know, in working in the battered women's movement on a national scale. But one of the things that, you know, we have to keep in mind is historically, is when the Europeans came over to the United States, to Americas, to settle, they came over with their own set of values. And one of the things that they devalued very much was women and children. Women and children did not have a status in the European culture. They were considered to be properties.
Chattel.
Yeah. Of men. And they had nothing that, you know, for one thing, you know, the things that came on later, like the right to vote and, you know, this sort of stuff came on years later. But up till when they first came over, they came with a real patriarchal view that men were supreme and women and children were, you know, marriages were arranged for economic reasons. And women had no power or status within that culture. And so then you had, until the suffragist movement, women that were second-class citizens, and then you had that sort of thing going on. But what you also had was that the societies, the indigenous societies that the Europeans encountered, the women and children had status within those societies. Indian women were in leadership positions and had power and status within those societies. What happened was that as they encountered the indigenous people, they did not want to relate to women who were leadership positions. And so then what happened with many of the tribes or the societies was that they selected a male spokesperson to deal with the Europeans. And indigenous women did not take on, they were not considered to be properties. They did not have to take on another their husband's names. They were known by their own name within their own society. And so you have that, you know, this real contrast that existed, already the unbalancing of that power structure. And then how they related to one another. And historically, when you read a lot of the histories about women, you saw here in the northeast part of the country where women were, you know, worked in the factories, the textile factories, that's the sewing. You know, this is what women did, you know, 10, 12 hours, 15 hours a day. Children, you know, worked in those same conditions, you know. Congress had to enact legislation to protect children from work. Congress had to pass the child abuse law of 1974 to protect the violence against children. But Congress has never passed that sort of legislation to protect women. It's been attempted, but it's never made it. So what happened then in that process is that as we view the whole area of power and control, is that a lot of the state, they have a tendency to, what initially happened in the 70s was that we looked upon violence against women and children as a social problem. The political move now is that it's a crime against women and children, the violence is. And so what has happened is that states have passed and enacted legislations like the pro-arrest bill, the mandatory arrest bill, domestic abuse bills, to provide protection for women from their abusers.
So it's very much like any other assault, in as much as...
The whole idea is to view it as a crime.
Right. The perpetrator will be arrested for assaulting that human being. Yeah.
Because what has happened is that simple assault charges, aggravated assault charges, the general stuff, the generic stuff, never, you know, hasn't really given the kind of protection that women need.
Because domestic violence has always been seen as a personal problem, right?
Right.
It's in the home.
It's in the home. It's behind closed doors.
Yeah.
You know, legislation did not, and you have to, you know, does not go behind closed doors. And you have to keep in mind, when you talk legislation like that, we're talking about who's in positions of power. You know, Congress is predominantly men. Our state legislatures are predominantly men. Our councils, you know. And so then you talk about there is that real imbalance of power. And when we talk about, you know, women in battering situations, in domestic abuse situations, you know, it's always that she's in that relationship, is maintained in that relationship because of the threat of violence, the fear of being herself being physically violated, you know, the fear of being physically assaulted by her perpetrator. You know, and it, oftentimes that's what keeps her in that situation for long periods of time.
Why is that from your perspective? Is it if she leaves, she will be beaten worse than if she stays and does whatever it is that he says she needs to do?
A lot of that is that the fear of being beaten, he uses fear to keep her under his control and power. Fear is a weapon that he uses very well. We do take a look at, you know, the fear of being, he uses, he might use the children. You know, if you don't do things the way I want you to, I'm going to take these children away from you. I'll take custody of these children because you're not working and I'm working and I can provide. You know, so he's using the children. He uses isolation, isolating her. He decides who she's going to interact with, when and where. How she's going to interact. You know, even her friends are no longer good enough for her, but his friends are good enough for her. So he takes care of who he controls who comes into their home. You know, and initially, you know, maybe her friends would come over and visit her, but he would make them feel so uncomfortable that after a while, they don't come over anymore. Or he's real suspicious when her friends begin to come over. So he isolates her. Makes her friends, makes her family, makes everyone uncomfortable, so they don't want to come over to visit her, you know. And you know, we talk about it, that sort of isolation. There's the other kinds of isolations that you find out in rural areas where, oftentimes, you know, living in the mountains or you know, there's the distance of isolation, and so the isolation that he builds upon where she begins to like she's not. Her self-esteem is dependent on him. He says that she looks nice with her hair down, you know, or with her hair up, you know. And he becomes very suspicious when she changes her hairdo, becomes very suspicious when she decides to wear a skirt to work. You know, and so, you know, that's another way to be able to keep control, is that it's to instill that fear, emotional, abuse, telling her that she's not any good. maybe, you know, if it's a second marriage, his first wife is better than she was. She was a better lover. His mother's a better cook. Why can't she ever do anything right? You know, so he uses a lot of letdowns, you know, just always at her emotionally to make her feel like she really can't do anything. She really can't go through life without him. You know, sexual abuse, you know, deciding when and where they're going to have sex, You know, even as far as reproduction, you know, reproductive, you know, having babies, he's in control of that. You know, how many babies he wants, or if they don't want it, or if he doesn't want any children, you know. So he uses a lot of this intimidation, you know, making her feel. All he has to do sometimes is shout or raise his voice or his eyebrow, and she knows, you know, the body language, you know. And so it's very so much of it we do and we're taught very well by society as women.
But
this is that this is what we were to expect, you know, in a relationship. That a lot of times we're taught very early on that as women that we're to be taken care of, you know, we're to obey, do as we're told. And a lot of times we get into a relationship and sometimes we buy that to a greater degree. You know, it's very inappropriate for young women in their teen years to be aggressive in play. We consider that to be inappropriate. There is a time that we allow ourselves, or we say it's okay for young women to be aggressive in play, and we call that tomboy. But we're supposed to outgrow that. You know, we're supposed to outgrow our tomboy years and then turn ourselves into little ladies. And we're discouraged in the school systems from excelling in math or science because, you know, it's no way to get a man when we grow up, you know. And so we talk about a lot of this ties into the whole issue of who's in control in our society or who's in control in our home. You know, how is that person supported by the dominant society? And so there's a real imbalance oftentimes that gets created as a result of that, where women, you know, I remember when I was leaving my abuser and I said, well, you know, I don't want to see you. I don't want you to call me, you know. And he goes, who's been talking to you? Yeah. So they really believe that we can't make these kind of decisions. And so as a result, I've seen women who have been away from their abuser for 2-3 weeks, and all it takes is a half a minute with them, and they're back with them because they haven't developed that inner strength to be able to say no and to believe that when they say no, they mean no. And so it takes a long time for women to go to work through those issues of battering. And you know, one of the things that I always do with women is, you know, how can I help you get back some control or power back, you know, back into your life? Yeah, go ahead.
Tell me more about the man. What? I can understand from what you're explaining where the women's motivations are, why they stay, why they feel trapped, it sounds to me like almost are hostage to this relationship, have very little control, very little self-esteem after a while, don't know when they put their foot down that they've put their foot down. But where does this violence emerge from in the male?
You know, like I mentioned before, you know, violence is learned.
Mm.
And one of the things that I always use to illustrate this is, like, when I do sessions, when I work with women who would be coming to the shelter, and a lot of times, you know, what happens is that they'll have a toddler with them, a little 15-month-old toddler in Pampers, you know, and still roaming around, and their attention span is less than 10 minutes, if lucky. And a child would come up, you know, say door to the mother because, you know, and the mother's not quite ready to go yet. You know, she still has a lot of things that she needs to get out. And so we give the child some more toys to play with, and comes back and goes, door, you know, comes back again, says, go. And then maybe after the fourth or fifth time, the child will waddle up to the mother and makes a gesture of hitting her on the leg.
Mm-hmm.
And I just stop everything and I say, do you know what has just happened? And she goes, no. He wants to go. But do you know what happened? You know, what was the gesture? You know, he hit you. Somewhere this 15-month-old child has already learned that in order to control another person, you have to be physical. And many of the women don't make the connection at first. And a lot of people in our society don't make the connection at first. That such a simple act, while it's really a violent act of spanking, which society condones, you know, we say, well, this is our child, and if you want a certain kind of behavior, you discipline your child. And some people will really firmly believe that by disciplining, we equate it with hitting. You know, that spanking is going to make this child do something no more, and that's really true. You spank a child, and they're going to remember the fear of being hit. And so that child at that early age has already learned that in order to control another person's behavior, you have to do it violently. There's always that fear of getting hit.
Okay, so why would one adult want to control another adult's behavior, especially in what we talk about as a loving relationship?
You know, along with the idea of spanking, what do we say when we spank someone?
No.
What else do we say?
Bad.
We say, I'm only doing this to you.
Of course.
For your own good.
Right. And also it hurts me more than it hurts you.
It hurts me more than it hurts you. I love you. That's why I'm doing this. And we proceed to spank the child or to severely punish them. You know. And what does that do to us as we grow older is that we equate being loved and loving with the physical act of a violent act of spanking. And so we're learning very early on that spanking is an acceptable way of loving a person. And as we internalize that, we see this, that if we grow up in a violent home, or we grow up seeing our mother being very powerless, maybe she doesn't get physically hit, but she's very powerless in the home. You know, she is the type of person that will bring the slippers and, you know, everything for the husband when he comes home, or make sure food is on the table at 5 or he will get upset. You know, his certain clothes have to be laid out for him or he will get upset. So in order for him not to get upset, she does these things. She has learned that, you know, because one never knows if they're going to get hit. You know, and so we learn very early on that this is what love is, or how we express caring about another person.
But you know from your own life and your own experience that the violence that exists in a battering household is not just spanking. I mean, broken bones, fractures, cuts, strangulation, awful things exist in those relationships. Is that a logical extrapolation from the equation of discipline with love? Does that really follow?
I think if it goes unchecked, it does. But a lot of it is, you know, the fact that, you know, we all learn. Some of us learn not to be violent, you know. Some of us learn to be violent. Some of us learn to accept violence as a way of life. Some people say, no, this isn't my way of life. I'm not going to live in a violent relationship. You know,
and others pour things like anger and frustration and whatever else into that outlet, into violence.
Right. And if, you know, even with the spanking, the idea of a child being spanked, in our society, children... Our society sometimes hates the children. You know, I often think about like how, you know, in the society that I grew up, children are considered to be sacred. Okay. In this society, children are not considered to be sacred. you know, we have to teach them to, and that's where we, you know, a lot of times we equate their, the idea of discipline with punishment, mm-hmm. and that children only learn through that, you know. And so it gives children a real lopsided view of their own power. You know, society, you take a look around you, even in their homes, you know, simple things like, where are the light switches? You know, where are the mirrors? Where are the toilet stools? You know, are they child-oriented? Yeah.
Oh, hi.
And you're walking down the street with a child, and a parent is walking hand-in-hand with the child, but the child is taking, you know, six steps to the parent's one, and he's walking at a, or she's walking pretty fast, and this child's running to keep up. And what does the child see? But all, nothing but belly buttons. And so we really disempower our children, too. And
what does that mean to you? What happens to a child who can't reach the light switch or has to take six steps to a mother's one? What happens to that child?
I think that child learns very early on that well, I guess what I see when a child is doing that is that that child has a real potential for wanting to be in control.
Because he's so out of control now?
Yeah, that's something else is controlling him.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, and those are real simple things in a home, you know. And when we try to say that, it's because of the safety of the child. But it's like we also do this for women, you know, well, I don't want you to take the car tonight because of safety reasons, whatever. But oftentimes that's not expressed to the woman. You know, it's more like, well, you can't take the child. You can't take the car tonight. And so when we work with children, the children programs, oftentimes children are forgotten, you know, that they have feelings, that they're capable of reasoning, and that they can love and can be hurt. And that battering among two couples affects their children. A lot of times we overlook that. You know, and we have horror stories of children who have established their own defense mechanism for coping with the battering that goes on in their home. I had a young woman that I worked with for a long time who kept going back to her abuser, and he was violent, really violent with her. I think it was like 3 years down the road, she came into the shelter and we spent about a day with her. And she made a connection then that she saw her own mother in a battering relationship all her life. And she really saw her mother as being real disempowered and powerless. And it wasn't until she was able to connect that, make that connection, that she was able to start working on her own issues of battering.
Because she began to see the generational chain?
Yeah.
It's my mother, it's me, it's my child.
Yeah, and it was always for her, it was like, why do I keep going back, you know?
Right.
Because she had worked as an advocate, she had done this stuff, you know, and then it was like she just was drawn back to it. And finally it was like, but it was real devastating for her to make the connection with her mother. You know, it was just like somebody pulled the rug out from me, like, gee, I see my mom as a battered woman. I never recognized or acknowledged that my mom was a battered woman, you know. So once she was able to make that connection, then she was able to start working on these issues, you know. But a lot of times, you know, that's not possible, you know. And, you know, there are a lot of issues that, you know, relate to battering. And they cross all cultural, as well as all the isms that exist. You know, and I'm a formerly battered woman. And at the time that I was in a battering relationship, I had a master's degree in counseling. I was working at a community college, and I still got involved with a man that was a batterer. It took me 3 years to really get out of it. It took me a long time to heal afterwards. And it's something that, you know, I thought I had it all together at the time. But we never know. And it's a risk. Women are a great risk. Because women are, it's becoming more acceptable for women to go into multiple consecutive, you know, relationships than it was, say, 20 years, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you know. Women bought into that old ideology that you got married once and you stayed married the rest of your life till death did you part. You know, women no longer buy that. You know, women are into, can get a divorce and can remarry. But that places them at a greater risk. Mm. You know, because the majority of women who get battered are women. You know, and so it does place women at a greater risk in relationships.
Once again, if you tuned in late or if you need a reminder, you're listening to Tilly Black Bear. She is from the Rosebud Sioux Nation in South Dakota. For 4 years directed the White Buffalo Calves Women's Society and is currently the chairwoman for the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. She is also a founding mother of that organization. We're talking today about battering. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. Talk to me about the transition time. What changes come to a woman who says, I can't have this happen to me any longer? What does she need to do? What lies in front of her? Some people who will be listening to this program will have been in or may be in a battering relationship.
I think once a woman acknowledges that or recognizes that, what really makes a decision that she doesn't want to stay in a battering relationship, that she wants out, needs a lot of support. She needs a lot of support from other people who have made it or other people who are working on battering issues. And because it's so, you know, what I've seen in working with couples is that he becomes really, her partner becomes, he just goes off the wall because he knows he's lost control over this woman. And she's real vulnerable, very, very vulnerable. And so she needs all the support that she can get, that it's okay for her to get out of the relationship and to live a life free of violence. The tendency for many people in the helping professions, whether they're priests, medical doctors, counselors, social workers, is that many of them strongly believe that the family needs to be left intact. And so many of them buy into that. And so that oftentimes they're not able to provide the kind of support that this woman needs, because they would rather have her work and believe him that he's going to quit battering her. And when he makes all these promises that this isn't going to happen anymore. But the woman herself, you know, it does take a long time to come through and to build up one's self-esteem and to say, I don't have to live this way. I don't have to accept this life. I can change it. And that she's in control of her life. But it takes time to do that.
Hard to believe that when you have been told that you're not in control of your life.
Right. And it takes time for women to have to deal with all the stuff. And that's why, you know, there are programs, you know, that we call the transitional housing programs, where I know that in Fairbanks here, we have WECA. And they have a facility for transitional housing for women. And there's a lot more programs throughout the United States to address that need. And one of the things that always happens is that for many women who chose to come out of a battering relationship and who choose to say they want a life without violence, free of violence, there's always the name baiting, the name calling that goes on. People are always suspicious. And so a lot of women have to work through a lot of different issues, and also they have to work with the idea that, work with their children, that the violence-free home that they're working on is an appropriate way to raise children, you know. But a lot of times what happens is that, you know, it's like, well, you need a man in your life. You need a man. These children need a father, you know. Even if he kills it, they still need a father. Oftentimes that's what happens. Mm-hmm. And so, it's going to take some real good, strong support network for the woman.
The domestic violence movement has been accused over the years of wanting to break up families. What do you say to that?
I think that as we give women the kind of support they need to want to live a violence-free life, we will always be accused of that. Because, you know, we're looking at a society that's patriarchal in system, and that when we start to say that, you know, men are violent, men have learned his violent ways, it's a real threat. It's real threatening to them. And women themselves will make the decision whether they want to stay with that man or whether they want to leave it. That's their decision. We support them in whatever decision they make. And there's more and more programs cropping up here and there, you know, men against violence, men looking at their own role, you know, in how they perhaps could work as allies in the women's movement.
How do you see a healthy family? What's a healthy family to you?
A healthy family to me is individuals that are within that have self-identified as a family unit. And that are, to me, able to share, to be supportive of each other, and to accept each other's differences. Yeah, to me, that's what a healthy family is. There's different kinds of definitions of family. You know, the most sociological one that we always do is the nuclear family with 2.5, a man and a woman and a half a child, or one and a half children, whatever it is now. But there are different kinds of family. You know, I've been a single parent family. I've also been a single parent foster family. But I also come from an extended family, a large family network, and we're all considered to be relatives with each other. And I think there are people that are dysfunctional in our family system, but that doesn't necessarily make the whole family a dysfunctional, you know, unit. And I think what we're looking really at is healthy relationships between individuals.
Tilly Blackbear, you have been working, I understand, at least recently, on the area of spirituality and the women's movement or domestic violence movement. The one thing I read was that you said that I see myself as a relative to nature. I see myself as part of the fabric of nature, and this is the umbrella under which lies my spirituality. Is that accurate, and can you expand on that? What does that mean to you, and how does that add to the work that you do?
Yeah. Spirituality is something that I really believe is attainable by lay people, and I consider myself a recovering Catholic. But my spirituality basis is the Lakota spirituality, which is the traditional spirituality that existed within my tribe. And one of the things that we believe in is that we're all related. All our prayers are ended with a simple saying, Mitako Yasi, which means all my relatives are all my relations. And what that is that we consider ourselves to be related to nature, to the two-legged, the four-legged, to the plants, the rocks, you know, that they're, the moon, the earth is considered to be our grandmother. The moon is feminine. And so we're all related in that respect. And therefore, when we're related with each other, we're taught, the way my system was, that the society that I grew up in was that you always addressed each other by how you were related. And in our society, there was words that said older brother, younger brother, older female cousin, younger female cousin, younger sister. You know, there was words that were, and this is how you related to each other. And it was, whether it was to an animal as well, you know, there, it was all being related. And from that being related, you know, it also, you're all part of a circle, you know. And being part of the circle, you know, we believe that old people are considered to be young people. And babies that are born are considered to be old people coming back. So there's this whole circle, you know. And you know, in just day-to-day talk, our elders are considered to be that young girl or that young man over there, you know. And so you always give them that respect as to, or and then babies are said to, well, this old man, you know. And so it's something that, you know, you grew up with, and you bring that further. And as you work on, I've been taught that, and this is in ceremonies and sweat, is that spirituality is something that anybody can attain. Yet it's in contrast to organized religion, such as, you know, I grew up in a Catholic church. I went to a Catholic boarding school, mission school, and religion there, or our spirituality, was always kind of placed up here, where only the nuns and the priest, you know, ministers, pastors were could reach spirituality. Their wives or people that were good in the church were good people, you know, and that we only set aside a certain amount of hours a week for our spiritual growth. Whereas in where I come from, it's a day-to-day thing. It's a belief system. And it's not organized, where you don't go to a place to pray. You pray wherever, you know, and to whoever. And, you know, there's prayers that we were taught, that everything, you know, the wind, the directions have all sacredness to them. And certain animals have certain, you know, that are sacred to us. And so, in fact, all the indigenous people of this land had those kind of belief systems at one time.
And what value do you think that has for this movement, the movement in which you work?
I really started to work in that area when, or started to start becoming more and more vocal about it, was when I seen Indian men using it as a means of control. You know, as a means of instilling fear in women that were their partners, and women who did not know some of the sacred ceremonies, or who had never participated in some of the sacred ceremonies, and these men were using it as a way to be able to have them come back to them, and saying, well, you know, it took me a couple of ceremonies or a couple of purification rites to bring you home. And the women were feeling like, you know, he has some control over me, even in that part of my psyche or my life. He has that control.
He has some magic I don't have, some power I don't have.
And so that's where, you know, I start tying it in to that whole, that we have to recognize that. And the other part of that, too, is that for many of the women that I worked with, many of them belonged to organized religion. And I also saw that for women, and in particular Indian women and Indian people, the oppression by the churches was really great, steep and intense. It's been going on for hundreds of years. And I think that needs to be recognized. You know, authority. We've been indoctrinated or acculturated into Christianity. You know, and there is a, in the lower 48, especially among the Plains people, there's a renaissance towards the old way of spirituality. And I had to go through some stuff myself, like when I chose to go back to the old way, it was like, I'm a Catholic, and my Catholic church says that this is heathen worship. This is, you know, false gods. When I pray to Grandmother Earth, when I pray to the sun, to Tugashilas, the spirit beings, and I had to deal with this in my mind, you know, like, is this really the way I want to, is it acceptable? And then it was like, something somebody told me, said, well, if it's something that my grandparents, my for generations, this is the way they believed, it must be okay, it must be good, you know. But I had to work through that. And it took a long time. Well, it didn't take a whole lot of time, but it did take some thinking and some talking. Yeah. You know, and that's kind of where a lot of that has evolved out of.
We have just minutes left, but I want to ask you one question that goes back to early in the hour. You said you thought domestic violence would be around for a long time. Where do you see, I guess I want to know, where do you see that the changes must be made if this aberration is going to be taken away, shrugged off, stopped?
A good example is probably just what happened in Alaska here. The funding for the shelters for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, that funding was cut by the state legislatures. But the money was left intact for disposable waste. I think that illustrates how the patriarchal system supports one another. And as long as we have the missile silos that are around all over, you know, the violence that keeps other people under control, what's happening in the Middle East, violence against women and children is going to be around for a long time. And I think people need to recognize that.
Has to be a major shift in thinking.
Yeah, well, yes.
Spiritual orientation to the world, is that too great a phrase? Is that one of the things that has to change?
I think this year, you know, we have seen a lot of changes nationwide. Mandela being released, the law coming down.
Yeah.
But we also see how easy it is to take up arms, you know, how easy it is to try to instill fear into another nation for us to stay in control. You know, as long as we have those weapons, the missiles, as long as we continue to elect people to Congress, to state legislatures, to support the patriarchal system and that way of thinking, violence is going to be around for a long time.
Tilly Blackbear, thanks for an hour. You've been listening to Conversations. Tilly Blackbear, once again, 4 years the director of the White Buffalo Calf Women's Society at the Rosebud Sioux Nation in South Dakota. She is a founding mother and the chairwoman for the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. I'm Susan McGinnis. You've been listening to Conversations. Join us again next week.